I made a mistake in something I said last time, and it caused some confusion, so I wanted to make that correct. A good friend told me about that, and so I appreciate that. I had said incorrectly that the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were the same thing. They're not. They're two separate feasts. They're usually contiguous, but they're two separate feasts. So I just want to make that right. Even though the Passover involved the unleavened bread, because obviously that's how we know what to take the Lord's Supper. But I made that mistake, so I wanted to correct that. Probably not the only mistake I made, but at least that one I wanted to correct. So now let's do our who, what, where, when, and how for where we are in lesson number 8. So where we are is Ezra is now finally going back to Jerusalem. Everything up to now, he's been recording what's been happening there among others, and not himself, but now he's actually going back to Jerusalem. And the one who is the king now is Artaxerxes. So we have gone from Cyrus to Cambyses to Darius to Ahasuerus, who is the king that was there dealing with Esther, and then now we're Artaxerxes. And there's some debate as to whether this is Artaxerxes the first or the second, but most scholars tend to think this is Artaxerxes the first. And he is the king that the Israelites are dealing with from Ezra chapter 7 through the end of Nehemiah. So we're kind of in his realm there. Now, how many years approximately has it been, and there's an error on number one, it should be 7 verse chapter 7 verse 1. How many years has it been when it talks about after these things? Approximately.
60.
Yeah, I've heard everything from 55 up to 90. So it's at least been 3 generations. It could have been 4 generations. So it's a long time. And you know, as Esther mentioned before, I mean, it's a long time, and there's a lot of disappointment, and there's a lot of things that they fall short of. So you know, that calls on their endurance, and obviously our life as a Christian calls on our endurance. So what we see early in this chapter is that Ezra traces his lineage back to Aaron. Now, why is that important? Right. So he traces his lineage not only back to the tribe of Levi, but he traces his lineage directly back to Aaron. So that means he is in the high priest line for being the high priest, which is very interesting, because when you look at what he's assigned to do, he is very much like our high priest. He establishes the law. He establishes, you know, he has the right to rule, and he has the right to establish the punishment for not obeying the law. So I think that's very interesting. So he goes all the way back to Moses, back to Aaron, and establishes himself as one of the direct descendants of Aaron. So I think that shows how important that was to him. And also that comes up later on as they begin the journey. They have some issues in that regard. So this is a phrase that occurs throughout the book, throughout the chapter. And I want to get your ideas on it. This idea that God's hand was upon us, or God's hand was upon him. What do you think that means?
There's some providence going on.
Okay, God's providential care. Yeah, absolutely. Have we seen other examples of that in the scriptures earlier?
Yeah.
Who?
Well, even back to Cyrus, right?
Okay, back to Cyrus.
He stirred up the spirit of Cyrus.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when Joseph was sent to Egypt, what did people notice about Joseph? What's that? That's right. Everything he did prospered in his hand. Every place he was successful. Even in prison, he was very successful. Bless you.
Thank you.
Because he became not only a model prisoner, he actually became the vice warden in that prison. So we see that God's hand was upon him. So what other things do you think that might have involved? His providence, his care. What other things do you think that might have involved?
The opposite is the hand may have been heavy on them to do what they're supposed to do.
Right.
And the burden of not doing what they're supposed to do.
Absolutely. And we'll get into that very very deeply in the next few chapters where their sin is pointed out. So it's very noteworthy that we see this phrase throughout these two chapters, 7 and 8. So I think we'll see that come up over and over again. So how is Ezra described? What does it say about him?
He's a scribe, he's skilled in the law of Moses.
Okay. So he's a scribe and he's skilled in the law of Moses. Now, what was the scribe's job to do?
Write down the words.
Okay. To make copies of the words. And that's very noteworthy because where have they been for almost 70, 80 years? They've been away from the temple. And so we think that's very interesting. And one of the things that I thought was very important that you can kind of slide by it if you don't watch it is, we'll talk about that in just a second. So he's a skilled scribe. He is knowledgeable of the law. What does it say about his attitude toward the law? What does he decide to do?
He has a passion for it. He set his heart to study and practice the law and to teach it.
Okay. So there's a couple very important things there. He had a passion for it. He set his heart to learn it. He set his heart to practice it. And he also set his heart to do it. So what is the application that we can draw from that? Our applications, which is the problem.
He didn't trust in his education. You know, he could have easily, being a scribe, it was more than just jotting down and copying his words. He would be comparable to one of our lawmakers today. He would be as sophisticated as a lawyer, knowing rule of law, very highly educated man. And yet he put his confidence in seeking the Lord and understanding his will, that was predominant in his life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And who else do we see earlier, or almost in this same period of time, or a little bit earlier, that set their heart to a certain direction? Daniel and his three friends. They set their heart to say, okay, we're captive to this land. This is not our home. We've been taken away from everything that we know. But we're going to do what is right in God's sight. And wherever the consequences may be of that, that's what they're going to be. So how do we apply that in our lives?
He was preparing himself. So that's not an overnight thing. That's mm-hmm. something you've just worked on. And over the years, it builds that trust and faith in God. That he is who he said he is. Those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But the idea of preparation mm-hmm. I think is important.
Right. Setting your mind in advance. It's like one individual said, when you become a Christian, you're signing a contract, but the entire contract is blank. And you're letting Jesus fill it in. I think that's one of the things that's very important in our life is we have that dedication that wherever he leads us, we'll go. And we may not know where that is. And we may not know what that involves. But we will go where he leads us, Danny.
And it's more than him just learning. You know, it says that he had set his heart to teach the statutes and ordinances mm-hmm. in Israel. And so it was important that others knew and understand. So as far as interpretation of law mm-hmm. and understanding how that law should be applied, mm-hmm. he took great care and concern mm-hmm. That people understood it.
Absolutely. That comes up later in Nehemiah where they read the law, and not only do they read the law, they gave the sense of it. What does it mean? How is it applied? How does this change what we do? And those kind of things. So not only did he have a passion to learn it, he had a passion to live it and then to teach it. So why is it important to live it if you're going to teach it?
Example.
What else?
Yeah, that Jesus in Matthew 23 said about the scribes and the Pharisees that do what they do but don't follow their
do what they say, but not what they do. Don't follow their example. And there was a teacher I had in high school was a speech teacher. And he was exactly the opposite of everything he taught us. He would have his tie way off to the side over his shoulder and say, you always need to dress sharply when you're going to address a group. And you always need to speak distinctly. It's like, wait a minute, you're doing exactly the opposite. How are you going to teach us anything? But he was consistent with that. And we can see a phony very easily. We can see someone who says one thing but does another. And that destroys their example. So that's a great lesson for us. That we need to be consistent in our faith. Now, obviously we'll stumble and we'll sin because that's the nature of who we are. But we need to be consistent with what we say we believe by what we do and what we teach. Now, what are some ways, as an application to us, what are some ways that we can teach? Is it always standing up here?
I think by example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody else leaves work an hour early and records a full day of time. You don't do that. You don't make a big... You don't stand up and say, hey, listen, I am not going to do what you people are doing. You just live the example. And therefore, if your example and your teaching are consistent, that makes it a lot more, has a lot more weight to it. Yes, please.
At the Paul in Rome, I think it's in Romans,
mm-hmm.
He's talking about with the Jews that said that because they live contrary to the God,
mm-hmm.
that's why the Gentiles, you're profaning the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
So the word of God is not glorified because of the way they live.
That's right.
So it's very important that we be consistent, mm-hmm. that way we be glorified.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Be consistent with that and do the things we say are important, or people will say, well, that doesn't matter. Then, yeah.
It just comes to you, like decision-making process and things like that. Like a larger group like ours where, not everybody has all the details to all the information, and we have consistent leadership that makes godly decisions, that tries to do their best, that we can, even when we don't understand all the decisions that go behind it, we can trust a godly example that's been out there when there's been a consistent pattern of godliness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's a friend of mine who used to sell heavy equipment and like big bulldozers and big things, and his line usually cost more than some other products in the same business. Hey, how are you?
Good morning.
But they said, I can trust him because Gene's never lied to me. And they were willing to pay thousands more to get a product from Gene because they knew Gene wouldn't lie to them. And we need to be that kind of people, that we can be trusted. We can set an example without saying a word. And I think that's very important. So now we have the beginning of the journey. So what do we see happening at the very beginning of the journey?
We stop.
Okay.
And, well, it's purification.
Mm-hmm.
Then it precedes God.
Okay. And right before that, though, what happened to allow the journey?
Artaxerxes.
Right. Artaxerxes sent them. And what's really interesting is if you read the verse, and you may have different translations from this, it's very obvious to me, based on all the evidence, that Ezra was a very high official in the Persian government. Because you think about all the things he's given, and all the responsibilities he's given, and all the trust he's given. It's pretty obvious to me that he was a pretty high official within the government because of all the things that come next. So, and if you read verse, let's see here, where is it? Verse 14. Stuart, would you mind reading chapter 7?
And whereas you are being sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God, which is in your hand.
Okay. So there's a couple of very, very noteworthy things in there. First of all, the language that's being used there is saying he's being sent forth from the king and his seven counselors, which means he was probably right among all those counselors that the king had, and a very trusted and high official in the kingdom. So he's being sent forth from the king. And you can see as we go forward that obviously he had a great position of trust and a position of ability to get things done that the king trusted him. So he's being sent forth by these seven counselors. So what did you read in Esther about what these counselors did? What was their responsibility? What was their skill set?
In Esther?
In Esther.
They advised the king.
Okay.
They did have some knowledge.
Right. So they were somewhat analogous to the cabinet for the president. Yeah. They're trusted advisors. They're people that have the ear of the king. And they are people that are of great influence. And also it's very interesting that they describe them as they knew the times. What does that mean? And why was that valuable to the king?
Well, they knew what was the culture, what was brewing in the culture, where the king might not.
Right, because the king is very insulated sometimes from what's really going on. Because people are afraid to give the king bad news or afraid to tell the king the real story. And you have these seven counselors that had this knowledge not only of the law and were very skilled in the law, but also knew what was going on among the people and in the culture. And I think that's very important. So we have these seven counselors. We have the king. So when Ezra, you know, is asking for these things, you know, says his request is granted, who all does he have to convince in order to be sent on this mission?
Well, I guess you can't see.
Right, but who did he have to get agreement from?
The counselors.
All
the priests. Officers.
The king. And all the princes. Don't know how many princes there were. There could have been 10, there could have been 5, there could have been 70. I don't know. But there are a lot of people that Ezra had to make sure were understanding of what he was doing and also supported what he was doing. And so how successful was Ezra at doing this?
Apparently he was successful.
Very successful. And what did the counselors and the king do?
They gave him a lot of money and authority.
They gave him a lot of money and they gave him a lot of authority. And, you know, if you just read past that and say, well, you teach the law and, you know, but you think about it, Ezra is basically given charge of that entire area beyond the river. And he is given authority to teach and, you know, help those who are ignorant of the law. And he's also given what else? Right. He's given the ability to enforce. So he's the executive branch and the legislative branch and the judicial branch all in one. So it's an amazing thing when you think about that this Ezra, who was a Jew, who was a captive, is given all this authority. And you see that he had gained this trust of the people based upon who he was and what he did. And they saw in his life that the hand of God was upon him. And things succeeded in his hand. And what he tried to do was successful. And so they go into this. So now we have this decree that Artaxerxes makes and some of the things that he talks about. So we won't go verse by verse, but what are some of the things that are included in this decree?
Well, one that seems to stand out to me is I just sit back and I think about all these pagan kings. I mean, these are people with no respect of the God of Israel. Remember, this empire covers most of this planet, and when you consider Jerusalem and Israel, it's a dot. It's a speck of grain on the map of this empire. And yet there's such importance given to this God of Israel. And it's interesting in the language in verse 23, that Artaxerxes says in his decree, whatever is commanded by the God of heaven. And so this sets God apart from all other pagan gods, that such importance is given to this God of Israel, that he's actually the God of heaven. I don't know what the implications are. I don't know if this is just language that Ezra would respect and understand, or this in fact is what they believed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is really the influence of Esther and all the people that were involved with the things that she did for the previous king, and also Ezra and his allegiance to this God of heaven, because as you said, they may not have found themselves to be a servant of this God of heaven, but they were aware of this God of heaven, and they were aware of what this God of heaven had done in the past, and they were fearful, rightly so, of this God of heaven because of things that happened in the past. Yes, Esther.
So do you think they were standing behind to like work behind the scenes and like help with all these like the kings that were going on? Or why did he not go right away? Was he maybe too young or did he not?
That's a great question. I don't know. It may have been that the part that Ezra played was really something that needed to be done after the temple was reestablished, because he was involved in teaching and reestablishing the hearts of the people, and that may have been that the temple needed to be completed before his work was done. I don't know. It's a great question. I mean, I would assume it's in God's providence that God's working things out in his way. You know, we may have thought, well, get back there and teach all the people and then build the temple, or the altar and the temple, but it seems like that God wanted the temple built and then reestablishing the law and those sort of things.
Well, he was one of the main in captivity. He was with the people.
Right.
Daniel was with the court, and Jeremiah was coming back with the man too.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the timing that... I'm not really sure, but that may have been the reason why the timing worked out.
You asked the question, what was part of this decree? So verse 13 says that any of the people of Israel who are willing to go can go.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. Because how many folks had gone before? Approximately.
50,000.
About 50,000. So now there's more of them going, but obviously a smaller group, and I've seen estimates from 5,000 to 8,000. Don't know. But a smaller group is going. So that requires an additional amount of faith, because it's been a long time, as Esther mentioned, between when the temple was rebuilt and him going, and when the people went back. Yes, Ms. Ruth?
But the rest of that verse, so why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
I think that's a great point, because the Persians really had the view that the gods of the people were very important, and to appease all the gods of all the people was very important as well. Now, later empires, like the Romans, they didn't care a thing about that, just dominate the people. But the Persians seemed to be very set in their mind to give all the gods of the people their due, so that they would please that God, and therefore there wouldn't be wrath against the king. And what's interesting is, we also see later on that the people that are involved in the temple were not allowed to be taxed or told or whatever, but we find out from reading other sources that they also did this for other pagan temples, like the Temple of Apollo in Greece. They were given the same thing. So I think that was just the pagan king making sure that he had taken care of this God of Jerusalem. And they also ask that they may pray for the king and his sons. So I think that's part of the motivation, and making sure that they cover their bases there. So as we begin this journey, approximately how long, miles-wise, is the journey? Yeah, I've seen estimates all the way from 750 to 900 to 1,000. Let's call it 1,000 miles. So they begin the journey, and they go a little ways into the journey, and they stop. Where do they go as this kind of intermediate point? River. The town that goes to the river of Ahava,
yes.
Which from what I've read is, you know, 15, 20, 30, maybe 40 miles away from Babylon. So they've begun, and they've started to separate themselves from the king. Now, how long does the journey take?
Well,
4 months. Now, can you imagine? You're traveling 1,000 miles. The journey lasts 4 months. And it's not only you, but it's your wives and your children. So, they averaged about 8 miles a day, give or take. Because some of it was mountainous, some of it was, you know, so they averaged about 8 miles a day. And from my house to the building here is about 7 miles. And I can't imagine getting up at my house every day for 120 days and going 7 or 8 miles. But that's what they did. Now, that's an amazing thing, especially when you think about not only was it the men and their wives and their children, but it's also animals. It was also supplies and all these different things they had to take. So we see that it took a lot of faith to keep going. You know, because what were they concerned about when they were at the River Ahava? What were they concerned about?
Enemies.
Okay, enemies. Yes, and being ambushed. Yes.
There was no one from the tribe of Levi. Is what they determined.
Right. Except Ezra. So they had taken this journey. They kind of separated themselves from Babylon and kind of started their journey. And then they get to this place. And what does Ezra do to kind of get them ready to go on this trip? What does he declare?
Fast.
He declares a fast. Now, what is fasting? What is that normally associated with?
Prayer.
With prayer, okay. Major decisions.
Not eating.
Not eating. That's right. That's right.
That's all I
think
of the day.
That's right. So you can devote yourself. Yes.
It was to focus their attention on a specific ask that they had for God to support them on the trip. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, what does fasting do for you?
Narrows your focus. Okay. You're not thinking of 30 things going on, but just maybe one.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been so engrossed in a project or so engrossed in something you're doing that you get to the end of the day and say, I forgot to eat? And that's, I think, one of the many benefits of fasting is it helps you to separate yourselves, as you say, from those things and to concentrate completely on your objective of, in this case, praying to God. So they go and they find... So they have this fast, and what do they ask in the prayer, and why do they ask it?
Protection.
Okay, protection.
Because they told the king that they didn't need a guard.
Right. Right. So what did they said would be their guard?
God
would be their protection. God's hand would be over us. So they said, it would be a shame, I would be ashamed to go back to the king and say, well, you know, I know we said that our God would protect us, but a couple thousand troops would be great. No. And that demonstrates their faith, because they had said, our God will protect us. And what do we see among Daniel's friends about that idea? When they're under stress and under duress.
Well, they face another. Mm-hmm. Didn't bow down to the idol.
Mm-hmm. And they said, what did they say?
Well, God will deliver us, whether he delivers us from death or not.
Right. God will take care of us. He may deliver us from your hand, or he may deliver us, but God's going to take care of us. And they had that faith and trust. And that needs to be something we have evidence of as well. Because many people in the world have nothing. They have lies and error and fiction and all the things the world throws at us to say, well, you can rely on this. Well, you can have faith in this. But we as Christians need to show an example that there's something more than that. That we have something that doesn't change. We have something that is permanent. Something that's lasting. And the things that go on in this world, that's just part of living. That's just part of being in this world, but we're not of the world.
I think too.
Jason and Glenn and no.
I saw, you know, in there it says when they started the fast, it's the first thing they said is that they might humble themselves. Mm-hmm. And that humility, I think, is something, you know, it's not the first time they've gone. Like, they've got these letters, they've got all this power, they've got all these resources available to them. And even back when the first time they went to go and try to rebuild the temple, they would have gotten a lot of confidence, but it stopped. You know, it didn't. So there's, I don't know how God plays into that, and for even for ourselves, on just knowing what we know about our salvation and just having that kind of confidence that we know that we can, we could have, that we can have, but then also the necessity to couple that with humility.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because if we don't humble ourselves and understand, as the prophet Zechariah said, this work is not of men and of your strength, it's of my spirit and my power. So we need to be very, it's very important that we humble ourselves. And when things are accomplished through our, the things that we do, we need to be humble about that. We need to be humble about how all that happened. Who all was involved? Who all helped us in those sort of things? I think that's very important, because we need to recognize not only our dependence upon God, but also the contributions of other people. And that's extremely important, and we'll talk about that more as we get into Nehemiah, that's very important, part of the psychology that he had when he was the governor. So, Ben, you have something in Danny?
You know, the application I get out of this, too, is that we're going to occasionally waver, right? We're going to occasionally be fearful, and kind of this is how you react. You go to God, your fear, and your uncertainty, things like that.
Mm-hmm. You rely on Him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to what Glenn said, that, you know, it almost seems on the surface that Ezra may have made a mistake here. It seems that they had availability to take this protection. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it would have been wrong or a lack of faith for Ezra to have said, we'd be happy to take an escort with us. Mm-hmm. That's just prudence to do something like that. But apparently some things were said that they were going to put their trust in God, and now they have to.
Ooh.
And there is that sense of fear, and the fact that maybe, just maybe, Ezra probably did not act in the best way when he did not accept or refused or didn't ask for this escort. And now, I think he sees the peril that they may be in, the reality of where they're at, and he's seeing the lack of wisdom.
Yes, please.
To Danny's point, you know, throughout those passages, there's, you know, the hand of God is on them, and it's sort of like a conclusion. Like, people are seeing all the good things, saying, well, the hand of God is on them. It sounds that way. It says, for the hand of God is on them. But in this instance, it talks about Ezra talking to the king and saying, yeah, we don't need, or I don't know if forces were discussed, soldiers or whatever, but he says, you know, God will protect us, the hand of God is on us. And that's sort of the first time I've seen Ezra saying it, like Ezra's making the claim. And I agree that, you know, if you're going to make the claim, then you're going to have to go to God and ask Him for it. I think that's probably what occurred to him at the river.
Mm-hmm. And so when they do express this faith and they are given the answer from God in whatever way it came, what does that say about what we should do when we have a situation that is a daunting situation of a spiritual nature? What should we do?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Have faith in God. And have faith that God will work things out in His way and His time. Maybe not necessarily the way that we think they would work out.
That's what I was going to say. You have to be willing to accept His answer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And oftentimes things, as Jason mentioned a couple of classes, don't happen on our timeline. And we thought, this is the way to go. This is what's going to happen. Well, no. God had a different plan. And God had wisdom we didn't have. Go ahead. You have something else. David, sorry.
I was just going to say, we have to know our limitations and hand it over to God, because we get in the way. When we don't, then we mess things up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And once we hand it over, then things go smoother. Right.
That's right. It's like one person said, that when you pray and you give something to God, don't take it back. And we all do that. I do that. I have a weakness of, well, you know, I prayed to God, but now what do I have to do to make this happen? So, and we also have to rely on God to do His part and us to do our part. But sometimes our faith doesn't give us enough to say, okay, God, I don't know what to do with this. This is yours. So we need to work on that. And I need to work on that particularly. So, please.
I think you need to be willing to stop, too. Like, they've obviously got this huge undertaking in front of them. They're planning to go 1,000 miles. And they've got this huge group, all the logistics, and they've moved for 2 days. And now they're going to stop at a river for 3 days. Like, that's not how you maintain a good pace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, you have to be willing to just put everything on hold when you realize there's an issue to pray over.
Mm-hmm. And why would it be that they have this group of folks that have gone out there and then they figure out there's no Levites? Why could that have been a problem they'd run into? Was there anything for the Levites to do for the last?
No.
Right. They were at the temple. So they had to get these Levites to come with them, men of wisdom and men of good counsel. So they got those guys. So Ezra begins to speak for the first time in verse 27. What does he say there?
He praises God for helping with the whole situation,
Okay. Giving
the king the disposition to allow them to go back.
Mm-hmm. So he praised God, and he thanked God. What's the application for us? We should be thankful and grateful. When someone we pray for is restored from being sick, we need to say, thank you, Lord, for answering our prayers for brother or sister so-and-so. Or if there's something we're very concerned about, and through God's providential care, the answer comes. We need to be thankful for that. Because it's important that we do that. If you look in Romans, what is one of the key things that sends the Gentile world into depravity? They made one decision and another decision followed behind that.
Lack of knowledge of God.
They put God out of knowledge. What else? They were not thankful. Because what they did was they created these pagan gods to give thanks to for the blessings that God had given. They created Baal when they had good crops. They gave praise to Chemosh when certain other things happened. I think it was a victory in war and so forth. But we need to be very thankful people, and we need to set that example, especially with our children. Saying thank you, that goes a long way, and that needs to be part of our character, to be thankful and to be grateful for God's blessings, and to do that consistently. There was a hand back there.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that now that they're kind of maybe outside of what they thought was the physical protection of being close to the empire, mm-hmm. Now they're going out where they're going to be more vulnerable. It's interesting that Ezra's concerned about all the money, all the gold and silver.
Mm-hmm.
And who does he entrust that this is going to get to Jerusalem?
Ooh.
He puts this in whom he believes are going to be the most trustworthy, which says something about Ezra's leadership.
Ooh.
Here, looking over, understanding that not everybody in their company might not use the best judgment.
Ooh.
Or might be tempted to use this for selfish purposes. And yet you see here him entrusting these individuals with these items so that they're used for what they were intended.
Mm-hmm.
And now that says a lot about good leadership, whether it's in the home or in the church or at work, wherever it might be, that you use discretion, you use discernment.
Mm-hmm.
When you're entrusting others.
I guess you read my notes, so I appreciate that. That's a great point, a great application, exactly what I think we should learn from that. Yes, did you have a point?
Yeah, about the
grateful. You were talking about the Psalm 103 says, "Oh my soul, today, do not forget any of your benefits." And also, I remind the scripture where the Lord healed 10 lepers, and just one come back to
to give thanks.
Two things.
Thanks. Very important. So being thankful is very important, and also being thankful very quickly after the things we've asked for have been delivered, and not letting a gap of time come in there. As soon as we realize that God has delivered or has given us the things that we need to be thankful right there and right then, because sometimes that can lose its power if we don't do it. So, Ken, would you read Proverbs chapter 21, verses 1 through 3?
The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. Everywhere a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the heart. To do righteousness and justice and more acceptable to the Lord is sacrifice.
So what we see here is, once again, Ezra is giving thanks to God for the things that were put into Artaxerxes' heart. Now, I don't know if they were put into his heart by a dream. I don't know if they were put into his heart by some of his counselors saying, "Hey, this Ezra, you need to listen to him. You need to follow him." I don't know exactly how it was put into his heart, but once again, we see God's providence working through the leadership and saying he put this into their heart such that the things that needed to happen would happen. So that's, I think that's a great application for us to understand that God's providence will be working on behalf of those who seek Him, on behalf of those who love Him. And we may not see it. And I think the analogy is really neat here because it talks about a river. God can turn the river any way He wants to turn it because He is in charge of those things. And He is in charge of the nations of the world. And that gives me great comfort now with all the unusual things that are going on in the world. So, as Danny mentioned, they have all these precious metals and these things. And Ezra could have kept all those things himself. And he could have been the one to deal with all that. But what does he do? He finds men, as Danny said, that you can trust. And men of honor that will take this gold and this silver and keep it exactly as it is and weigh it out when they get to Jerusalem without any loss or without any damage or whatever else. And so I think the application to us is when we have something we need to do, what should we do in terms of getting things done?
Well, obviously, if it's too big for us, we can do no job.
We involve others. And that binds us together. There are talents that many of the people in this room have that I do not. I can't tell someone how to be a good mother. I can't. But there are good mothers in this room. I can't tell someone how to do something from a construction standpoint. But Jason can do that. And we need to find those skills among our brethren and allow them to be part of that community of help. So that binds us together. And that puts trust and faith in them. And you look at the example of the Grecian widows. The apostles could have stopped preaching and they could have served tables. But was that the best thing for them to do? No. Was the need legitimate?
Yes.
Was it significant?
Yes.
Could it have caused tremendous, tremendous friction in the early church? Yes. But they chose men, seven men who actually had Greek surnames, which is very interesting, to take care of that business. And we, when we come up against projects that are significant, we need to involve others. And there's two things that were, my father was an elder for many years, there are two things that were music in his ears. First thing was, "I prayed for you." Second thing was, "What can I do to help?" And we need to do that with the elders and with the deacons and with the classroom teachers and all those different things. We need to be part of being accomplishing those things. So just for next time, we'll be in lesson number 7, which is the last part, the last two chapters in Ezra. And as Esther gave us a preview of, this is one of the things that you're going, things are going good, you're making progress, and all of a sudden you find this problem that Ezra has to deal with. So we'll be in chapter 9 and 10 next time, lesson number 7.
This fact of the weighing, there's a verse about provide things honest and without problem.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he waited before and waited after.
That's right.
Remind me of Paul when he was taking the contribution to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. He had men from that church go with him.
Right.
Or even he said he would have to go, but he didn't. But he had those people to go to prove again. So everything would be no question.
Mm-hmm. Everything's done honestly, in order, and in a way that's organized. And God's not the God of disorder. He's the God of peace. And there's not a question, because they were given X number of dollars, or X number of pieces of silver and gold and all these things. And then when they went to the priest in Jerusalem, they were weighed out and everything was there, and they were men of faith that could be trusted. Thank you very much for all your great comments. I really appreciate it. And we will pick up in lesson 7, which is chapters 9 and 10, Lord willing, on Wednesday night. Thank you very much.
Tell Nathan, most of the time,